never tried to squash it or, you know, or anything, but there was some uncomfortableness, maybe just even on the staff level, seeing it as sort of competition or another place where educational initiatives were coming from, you know, whereas AFT wanted to see itself as the leader of education reform and largely has been, you know, at the national level. So I never thought there was an issue. I mean, for one thing, you had a whole bunch of AFT vice presidents that were part of it, you know, and I know Ed, for example, is like, these are my guys. You know, I said that too. Like, why should I be worried about this? I don't get it. You know,
right.
Sandy was a little bit of uncomfortableness at times. It seemed to come and go or ebb and flow. And I think some of it probably was staff being in her ear, maybe some presidents of really large locals, by which I don't mean New York, because New York was part of it, but some other very large locals that maybe found some of these ideas and initiatives uncomfortable. Didn't want reporters calling them up saying, well, you know, Minneapolis is doing X. Have you guys ever, you know, considered doing X? And they have a desire to do X, you know, peer review, let's say. So I think it was a little bit of that, a little bit of staff. Never was a terribly big deal. Never worried me, frankly, but it was there. So I only bring that up only because it has to do with the origin of your question. What was the origin of TURN? And that was really it. But it's been very successful. I mean, as a local president, trying to deliver the bread and butter, you know, be an effective bargaining agent in all the traditional ways, which you have to do, you absolutely have to do if you're going to lead people in a reform direction and take them out on a little bit of a limb with you and try some experimental things. To do all of that, you know, you needed a support group, a network to bounce things off of, and everybody stole everybody's ideas. But you know what else? It was like therapy. Mm-hmm. It really was. It was like, because you'd go through periods of labor management, you know, after you take the initiative. In our case, it was not born out of labor management cooperation at all. And by the way, this was another place where the AFT was a little off. They developed a theory that trying to figure out why these things were breaking out in certain places and how to maybe get it to expand. But their theory was it emerges where there is a mature collective bargaining local. That much I tend to agree with, but not always. And there is a high degree of cooperation, you know, labor management cooperation. Some places, but definitely not my local. And in a sense, I think that was a bad descriptor. It was a bad diagnosis, or not diagnosis, but yeah, bad descriptor to put on this initiative, because it gave everybody who didn't have good labor management relations an excuse not to even put their toe in the water and try to become an educational leader. We had to get there the hard way. We had a school board administration who didn't want to bargain with us at all. They had to do it. They certainly were going to try to confine it to wages, benefits, and hours, and, you know, very limited working conditions. So we had to fight our way to the table again. You know, after having fought our way to the table in the first place, we had to fight our way to the table again to get educational issues to be part of the conversation. And so we did it by going to the public with our ideas when, you know, management wasn't receptive, and sort of leveraging them into taking these ideas more seriously. And I think a lot of locals could do that even. And eventually what that does, it'll call, if you don't have a cooperative or enlightened management, you're much more likely to get one if you spend a few years banging away and leading on these issues. Eventually you're more likely at least to get some people on the boards or in the community saying, hey, why don't we get a superintendent who will work with these people? Have some pretty good ideas. They seem to really want to help improve things. Why don't we get somebody who will work with them? You know, or we got a vacant superintendent's, you know, turning over. Why don't we look for somebody who might actually work with them on this stuff? You know, that's what happened to us. And not forever, because superintendents come and go, but that was a phase that was really important. But we also a new board comes in, or some new board members, they decide the union's got too much power. The union's running the district. They got too much to say. The contract's getting too thick. There's all these other things in it besides the traditional things, and the superintendent having freedom of action, blah, 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 blah. So then they bring in this guy's job is supposedly to break us, drive us out of the temple and all that stuff, and then we had war again. Well, one of the things that was really valuable to me about TURN is when, you know, I'm Irish enough to get drawn into the fight, you know, maybe a little too readily. And so you'd be beating up each other, and you go to TURN and you go, oh, I almost forgot we were supposed to be we were supposed to be helping the kids. We were supposed to be like changing education to help the kids. It really was seriously a place to refocus, you know, several times a year and like reflect with people who are, you know, somewhat like-minded. It's really very valuable. And if it doesn't do any more than that, and that's really all it was designed to do. You know, it was never designed to be an organization. It doesn't have any officers. It doesn't have any policies. It doesn't pass resolutions. You know, it's just a network. And we've been pretty religious about, you know, keeping it as such. So that's my story. And then one of the things I'm involved in now that I'm real excited about is not really formally a part of TURN, but it definitely is something that grew out of TURN, which is this Institute for Teacher Union Leadership. The difference is that there's not a difference philosophically, it's just difference in sort of mission or function. What we're trying to do with ITUL is, and there were actually several false starts at creating something like this out of TURN or in and around TURN. And so finally we got one started. Let's hope we can sustain it. The idea is to expand the number of locals where educational change, reform, improvement, just plain results is a central focus of the union's, you know, work and thinking, and to help not only expand the number but also hopefully increase the effectiveness of local leaders that are trying to do that by, you know, creating an intensive development training program where we learn from each other, but we also learn from outside experts, so to speak, and we get context. We get a big picture context for this work. We're, you know, creating this as we go and feeling our way, but we've had two, we're just kind of wrapping up our first cohort of 9 locals. Mm-hmm. Very interesting is that, you know, the 9 locals we invited, we being just sort of an ad hoc organizing committee, again, that kind of came out of discussions in and around TURN meetings. We invited 9 locals, all 9 locals said yes. We were able to get, again, a little support from AFT, some from NEA, and modest grants from a handful of foundations that we now are at the point we've got to try to renew and hopefully increase. No staff, all you know, volunteer leadership. You know, and we've put on 2-week-long summer institutes for this cohort. It's a 5-member team from each of 9 locals. Several follow-up meetings during the school year and a site visitation, sort of mentoring process is a key part of it, you know, parallel component of it. So we're starting to think about a second cohort. We've got to get grants renewed. We really need to have at least somebody paid to part-time at least to coordinate and keep it moving. It's just, you know, with volunteers working on the phone, working on email, things just kind of stop and start too much.
Okay.
But I'm real excited about it. I think it's really important for the long term. There were 2 reasons why we thought it was very timely. But I guess one was, you know, the underlying reason was, why hasn't this kind of thinking grown, you know, expanded more to more locals? My theory is that a lot of the local leaders, when they hear about this kind of work, they hear about TURN begins kind of becomes the symbol or the representation of this type of thinking, although not certainly by no means are. There are plenty of locals that aren't in TURN for one reason or another doing really good educational work. Not like we think we have a monopoly on it. But there are a lot of locals who tend to think, you know, you'll hear them say stuff like, well, we don't do that sort of stuff, or we don't do that thing, or we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they really tend to think of, you know, traditional bargaining and bargaining issues versus this other stuff. I think they also believe that those of us who have been engaged in it do it out of some just idealism. Or they also think that people who do that kind of stuff are likely to get, you know, voted out of office. I think there's been some serious misinterpretation of some local elections over the last few years, in my opinion. I think it's at least as dangerous to not take up educational issues and to basically sit there and let everybody do it to your members, whether it's the superintendent, the governor, the school board, the outside experts, the consultants, whatever, or Secretary Spellings determine the educational agenda. I think your members eventually get real tired of you saying it's not our fault. We didn't do it. We didn't have anything to do with it. The Pontius Pilate approach to, you know, educational issues. I think that's what happened in Chicago. I'm talking about 2 elections ago, two regime changes ago.
Right.
It wasn't that they suddenly found themselves cornered where they had to engage in something called reform, but it was very, it was only sort of last minute, and in fact, by that time, they were under so much pressure that they did, in fact, agree to some stuff that I would never have agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, a school redesign plan where people can lose their jobs.
Yeah.
We negotiated a very bold school redesign plan. It was very controversial. Everybody was guaranteed not to lose their jobs. So in other words, there are lines you don't cross. But in that case, I think it was just too many years of Pontius Pilate. You know, we're not involved in that stuff. That's mm-hmm. coming from somewhere else. Well, maybe you should be. You know, aren't you our representative? Aren't we teachers? And isn't this about teaching? I mean, I don't think that necessarily is politically viable. And increasingly less viable as there are all these external demands for change that are mounting. So our view is we have to try to figure out how to, one, help people deal with the educational issues constructively, deal with the external demands for change, and also deal with the demands from your younger members to represent them professionally and provide professional help to them, while also delivering the goods, you know, economically and getting reelected. You know, that's our goal. So try to, in simple terms, is to try to help people figure out how to do that. Okay. So, the other thing, part of it is letting them in on, I guess I would call it our dirty little secret, which is, guess what? We're not just doing this out of idealism. This gets us more power. You know, hello, I guess it's our fault. We've been up there making all these presentations and conferences and workshops for years talking about all these great educational things we've done, and they tend to get presented as great innovations for their own sake, you know, and isn't this exciting and new and different? I mean, it's not really that new and different anymore, but, you know, along the way in the 80s and 90s it was. But what we probably weren't never explicit enough about is, you know what, at least in my town, this is how we got power. This is how we got the power to deliver raises every year. This is how we got agency shop and binding arbitration and grievances, which, you know, yes, some of you had long ago, but we still had to get in the 80s. We got it by developing leverage and power by standing for the right stuff educationally. That's how we got community support to keep the board from going after us, at least for many years. That's how we got the business community backed off, at least, if not, you know, supportive at times. It won by just sitting at the table and pounding on the table or threatening to strike if you don't give us, you know, what we want. That won't work anymore, you know. Won't work because teachers never really liked to strike. It's really hard to get them on strike. In my town, they had to believe it was, you know, instead of feeling like it's unprofessional, as everybody's going to tell them at the cocktail parties, you know, or in the letters from the superintendent, they had to believe that, in fact, under these conditions and for these demands, it's the only professional thing to do.
Right.
That's how we got power, you know. And so one of my goals in this program is that we got to share that secret, you know, so that maybe more folks will figure out that it's not near as risky to lead as it is to sit on your hands and let other people inflict upon your members all these stupid, you know, reforms and negative approaches. And then the other thing that made it timely, I think, that makes it timely, is that in the non-bargaining states, there is not this sort of rigid doctrinaire approach to what is or isn't the union's role, what is or isn't a bargaining issue. You know, where are the lines drawn, where that's somebody else's concern. A, because they're looking for any issue they can engage in that their members care about, right? Because they're trying to organize. And increasingly what the members care about is the stuff everybody's throwing at them. The new standards, the new tests, the new certification rules, the whatever, the restructuring, the charter schools. It's what's happening. And so instinctively, good union leaders who are good organizers are going to take up those issues. And again, the generational change, the younger teachers aren't, you know, they don't have any hidebound ideas of what a union is or isn't supposed to deal with. It just seems natural that if there's a problem, you know, that affects me professionally, affects us as teachers collectively in this school system, that, yeah, if we're going to support an organization, we want them to deal with it. So part of theory of operation here, or theory of action, is to get folks from also new emerging locals and try to help them figure out how to deal with these issues, but also how to tie them to economic, you know, gains for your members and stuff. So it's real exciting. It's something I hope to continue, you know, when I eventually retire, you know, something I want to keep doing as some kind of legacy.
Well, that's something that's actually going to bring bargaining, completely change bargaining over for teachers' unions.
It should.
Yeah.
If we don't, I think we're really going to lose the sort of cohesion, the loyalty, the support of younger members.
Here's what some of you, I think you said, or I think I read it somewhere else, where AFT started this craft union, moved the industrial unionism. Is this the new way of future for AFT and NEA?
Yeah, we hope. I mean, at least some of us hope. I think it's exactly right. Actually, if we started as a craft union, but the formative period of collective bargaining, teachers getting collective bargaining, 60s and 70s, you know, alongside other public employees, you know, municipal employees and stuff that were that, you know, beginning to get bargaining. We copied pretty much lock, stock, and barrel from the wave of unionization that preceded our wave, which was industrial unionism. Mm-hmm. And we pretty much copied lock, stock, and barrel, and much of what we borrowed has stood us in very good stead. I mean, the collective power, the militancy, the power of the bargaining process itself. And we were dealing with single employers, whereas craft unions dealt with multiple employers and had different kinds of structures for negotiating contracts and delivering benefits. So there was a lot to be borrowed, you know, but we didn't. We kind of borrowed everything. Not everything served us in good stead, or maybe it did for a while, and you know we needed to enter a new phase. So I think our view is let's borrow from everywhere that we can. Let's go back and borrow some of the things that craft unions have traditionally done. Peer review is an obvious thing. When I got pushback, and there were a lot, frankly. I think some people who think peer review is all that controversial, and their members maybe haven't tried, tested the waters, but got some. And somebody, of course, inevitably, you know, somebody's going to stand up at the meeting and say, this is anti-union. You can't have a member evaluating another member's anti-union. I said, oh, is it? You know, wow. Somebody needs to go down the hall here and tell the carpenters and over there, the asbestos workers on the second floor and the electrical workers up on the third floor that their anti-union practices, you know, that their local's been engaged in for about 200 years, and they better stop. And actually, that's not original. I mean, Dow Lawrence is the one who made that light bulb go off in my head because he started using that analogy when they first began to take their...
Yeah, it's so true.
On the road. It's very true, yeah. But the other thing is we should borrow from other professions where it's, you know, that aren't unions, but borrow from the components that make them a profession because our members aspire to be professionals, you know? And so why wouldn't we? And then we should also, the other thing that I think is really important, and Al certainly helped me and others with this, is take off our blinders and look at other countries.
Yeah.
I mean, we are so, not just in our union structure, but in our whole education reform discussion, God, we have just got such consistent blinders on. It's like even though the reform, contemporary education reform movement was largely fueled initially and still fueled by international comparisons of student achievement, we have tended to look for any other possible conceivable way to get to the results those other countries get, except to do what they do to get them. I mean, literally, we spent 10 years after Nation at Risk with random innovations, I'm sure I'm almost directly quoting Al on this, that had no relationship to what, you know, it was that other countries were doing to get better results. Finally, we copied one big idea from the rest of the world, which is having standards. And Al, obviously, and AFT were a huge part of moving that along. But now we have Americanized it in some very unproductive ways. We are over-testing kids, which they don't do near to this degree. And we've corporatized it. You know, we want to measure the productivity every, you know, 10 minutes. And unfortunately now our version of it, some elements of our version of a standards-based system are now being exported back to the rest of the world. And their unions over there having to fight, you know, this over-testing and accountability mechanisms that aren't very professional. But what we still haven't done is looked at, and I'm talking about the union, but also the whole education reform debate in America, pretty much still doesn't look at what structurally, how they organize schools and schooling to get the results they get in other countries. And so from the union standpoint, we really need to look at the fact that in most countries, you know, the structure of education obviously is, you know, integrally tied up with the structure, how you then structure the union. In most countries, the principal is still the principal teacher. They still teach. Mm-hmm. So naturally, they're in the union, you know? So that labor management polarization that we saw in our own, which was one of the reasons why we copied the industrial unions, because we were feeling alienated and polarized, and that's, you know, what gave rise to the sort of militant industrial union movement. Isn't there in these other countries, you know? And now in some countries, the principal doesn't teach, but they're still in the union, you know, like Australia. And I have a primitive theory about that, which is that even though they don't teach, what they don't have is the Melbourne Board of Education with the superintendent with this huge bureaucracy that the principal has to both fear and maybe aspire to climb into and suck up to, and sometimes, most of the time, that means beating up on the teachers to prove that they're, you know, worthy of being part of the administrative team. There's no such entity like there isn't in almost every other country. There is just, it's a state system, but there's a state ministry of education, and they might have some curriculum people and occasionally inspector and a professional or occasionally professional development workshop, but basically day in, day out, it's us and here right at the school got to figure out how to get this job done, and the principal and the teachers generally don't find themselves in, you know, warring camps, and so them being in the union isn't, you know, strange. So, I mean, the point is not that I'm not saying this model or that model is the best. I'm just saying we got to take off our blinders and borrow, you know, freely from wherever we can to meet our contemporary needs and our members' aspirations. And again, you know, Al helped internationalize the conversation. I really think we need to refresh or renew that effort to look both as a union and in a broader educational enterprise in this country to, like, look around, you know, and quit pretending this is the only possible way to organize schools.
Right. Well, I think you covered a couple of the other questions I had on that one.
In fact, Adam is talking about... He's been talking with us and with Ed about an international turn, in a sense, as he's kind of phasing himself out of leadership of the domestic turn. And I think that's a real exciting idea.
That's a page right out of Andy Stern.
In terms of, well, yeah.
In terms of international.
Focused on organizing internationally.
But he's talking to his equivalents over in England and Germany and creating...
That's what my wife does for him.
She does the international?
Well, she's the lead staff person on the global organizing partnerships.
Oh, I did that. Yeah. Oh, so she's always over in Europe and England?
Brazil, Australia, Hong Kong, Japan, Geneva, Paris, name it.
All over.
Chile, Argentina. You know, just in the last, she's only had this job for not even 2 years. So.
Wow.
That's she's got staff all over the world now. She does.
That's huge. That's huge.
Yeah, I mean, it's all still very experimental, but it's exciting. It's obviously something the industrial unions should have been doing 15, 20 years ago. You
know? Yeah. And I think we're about done. Is there anything that we didn't cover you want to talk about? Or
sort of dim on what we did cover, but I think we covered pretty much most of the my local career. Nah, nothing. I think I'll see the transcript and see what
cool.
Any glaring omissions.